Okay, welcome everyone to I think it's episode 5.
Yeah, welcome everyone. Today we are going to be playing for you an interview with Blair Fix, who is a grad student of environmental science at York University.
And a very cool guy.
He is very cool. We are talking to him about some of the work that he's done in political economy. So he works in the department. Well, he works with Professor Nitzan, who formulated capitalist power theory. And so, to explain that for listeners, just so you're not confused, capitalist power examines capitalism like the previous feudal and slave-based systems of statecraft as a way of organizing power rather than as a mode of production, the way that Marxism does. It holds capitalism as the core organizing principle, which measures assets and organizations in terms of the expectation that they'll draw in power, which is measured as money revenue. In other words, money is a form of power, and capitalists use finance, the science of money accumulation, to acquire power.
Yeah, just one small correction. You said there that that it holds capitalism as the core of as the core organizing principle, and what I think you meant was it holds capitalization as the yes.
I noticed lately when I've been editing like a bunch of episodes in a row that I know in my head that I said the correct word, but what comes out of my mouth is totally wrong.
So you're no. So you're not wrong. It's your lips that are betraying you. They
Yeah, my
can't
mouth is
quite
just
keep up.
dumb.
Yeah, your mouth can't keep up with the rapid progression being made by your brain.
Yeah, my extremely genius, huge brain.
High IQ alpha brain.
So do you think that was a decent explanation?
I think as a brief summary that explains it, that's perfect.
Yeah, I think when I was writing it, it seemed very good, and as I was reading it, it seemed a little confusing. But if anyone has questions about it, you can message me on Facebook or Twitter. So for Blair's research, he has two subjects that we're going to talk about for this episode. One is energy, growth, and hierarchy. And so the summary for that is Blair sought to examine current theories of economic growth to find whether or not they can actually explain what they seek to explain. The core problem with the current literature is that it isn't actually measuring anything. It's measuring, quote, growth, but can't define what exactly is growing. So Blair proposes an alternative analysis based on examining energy scale and human hierarchy. He finds that energy scale and hierarchy exhibit a significant relationship and examines why hierarchy is necessary for a capitalist organization.
Cool. Yeah.
And
That's what I
then
got from the paper.
the other subject is a capital as power theory of income distribution. So for this, Blair examined various factors as they relate to the distribution of income in contemporary society. He looks at factors that are currently used to explain income distribution more commonly, like level of education, race, gender, and so on, and compares these factors to the position that someone has within a business hierarchy. So, like, whether you're a low-level employee or the CEO. Were you going to say something?
No.
Oh, okay. So he found that the latter factor actually has vastly more explanatory power for income distribution than any of the other factors, which was surprising.
Cool.
Yeah. So it was a really good interview. I think it's a lot of fun to listen to. So we hope you enjoy it, and so we'll get to it.
Here we go.
Let's just introduce each other, I guess, a little bit before we actually start. I'm Ryan. I'm from Washington, D.C.
been following Professor Nitzan and your work, as well as some of the other York U people for a while. Peter and I have been doing this podcast since, summer last year?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yep. You want to introduce yourself, Peter?
Yeah, I'm Peter De Beer. I am a South African living in the Middle East. I have been following various forms of post-scarcity anarchism for most of my adult life. I'm not as well educated on the subject as Ryan is, so I tend to be more of the jokey type. I do love research, though. I wish I had the wherewithal to push through and finish a book, but I never seem to have the time. I currently work as a social media marketer and business consultant for some clients here in the Middle East, and takes up most of my time. And so the little time that I have left, I work with Ryan on the podcast.
All right. Well, my name is Blair Fix. I'm a PhD student at York University. This is my fifth year, so I'm writing my dissertation right now, trying to finish. I'm a student of Jonathan Nitzan's. His Capital as Power framework has really influenced my research. I read his book, I think, in 2012, before having taken any classes with him or anything. I just discovered this book, and at the time, maybe I would have considered myself an anarchist, maybe with Marxist inclinations in terms of theory. And then what his book did was really open my eyes to a brand new alternative. So my research, there's kind of two aspects of it. One is really interested in energy and the role that energy plays in society. And then the other aspect of it, which has been more recent, is a focus on hierarchy and social hierarchy and how that relates not only to energy consumption but also to income distribution. I've written a couple papers on that, and that's basically the content of my dissertation.
Your dissertation's on both? Or the hierarchy?
Yeah. It's about both. So okay. I think I've taken the easy road. In a dissertation, you can write... one option is to write three different papers and staple them together and call it a dissertation. And I've taken that route because it seemed easier and more practical to me, because who will read a dissertation after all? Like, very few people. So I had these kind of papers that are loosely related, and I'm in the process of writing a third, so I'll slap them together and that will be my dissertation. But yeah, it's about energy, hierarchy, and income distribution and how those kind of all interrelate.
Okay. Could I ask what your third paper is going to be about?
Yeah, the third paper... So I wrote a paper called, this is a working paper, called Evidence for a Power Theory of Personal Income Distribution. And the hypothesis was that hierarchical power, as I define it, is has the strongest effect on income. So I go through a lot of evidence trying to show that this is the case. In the paper that I'm writing right now, I basically take that idea and I develop a model of the U.S. economy and just try to see what it implies, what the model can tell us about how hierarchy affects income distribution. So it's very related to the previous paper, same ideas, it's just a little bit more detailed modeling.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
So I guess let's start with how did you end up studying Capitalist Power? Was it just discovering the book and then deciding that you wanted to move into that department, or
sure. I'm actually not in that department at all. So,
oh, okay.
I'm in the Faculty of Environmental Studies. Jonathan Knitson is in Political Science. Uh-huh. But my program is particularly open in the sense that I'm allowed really to create my own program. And it's interdisciplinary. So I took courses all over York. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but the faculty in York is a particularly left-wing university, and especially the political science department is very Marxist, which I was excited about going in. And I took three or four courses on Marxist theory, and I was really excited going in. And then when I came out, I was less excited. Because I felt like there was this... Well, I've always been skeptical of the labor theory of value. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that was... I was always radical. I thought the idea... You know, Marx's kind of central idea of class analysis was great. But then he had this kind of... This labor theory of value that I thought was just silly. But I didn't really know of any alternatives. And I all along had hated... neoclassical economics. So I didn't really know what else was out there. And one summer I just actually Googled, I think, the search term critical theory of capital. Okay. And Jonathan Knitson's book came up. And it's he's got a PDF online. So I downloaded it and read it just in one summer. And it completely changed my outlook on what I was studying. And so then I took his course, Jonathan's course, and not only was the content good in terms of his own theory, but I really liked his kind of scientific approach, because I had been kind of bogged down in my faculty. There's a lot of postmodernists in my faculty. Mm-hmm. And so they were really hostile of science, and I was kind of getting bogged down in that whole debate. So it was really impressive.
It seems like Marxism, too, is kind of not anti-science, but like not a very empirical study.
Well, yeah, I mean, it started out, I think Marx's idea was to have a scientific theory of society, but I think it very quickly got bogged down. On the one hand, there's just the practical realities of trying to have a vanguard party. And, I mean, I don't know how much theory you can have when you're trying to stoke a revolution. But then on the other end, there were these kind of problems with the labor theory of value that got swept under the rug. And really, the Marxists got left behind, and the neoclassical economists did all the heavy lifting with developing the system of national accounts and all the kind of empirical accounting structures that we have in economics right now are developed by the neoclassicists. So as a result, I guess Marxists kind of said, well, we don't want to use that data, so we're not going to use... I shouldn't say all Marxists, but some said, we're not going to use that data, so we're not going to do, you know, any empirical analysis. It's kind of dirty work. We want to do purely theory. I don't know. That's my impression anyway.
I have to agree. I've in most of the discussions that I've had with Marxists, I end up coming up against this wall of dialectics. And for some reason, they seem to think that you can talk your way through economics all the way, and I struggle because we're living in an era where the amount of data that is available on the subject of economics, it's astounding now. I mean, we're literally living in the big data era, and how you can still go on to ignore that, it boggles my mind. So I've actually gotten to the point where I no longer discuss economics with Marxists at all.
Yeah, I think they saw Piketty's work and then kind of were satisfied that, you know, all of Marxism has been validated by that one book. So who you're an environmental science. So who, what scientists do you like outside of political economy?
Cosmology, physics, actually. I was almost became a physics major, but the math got too hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided not to go that route, and I was probably wise, because I don't think I would have been able to make any kind of meaningful contributions to physics.
Yeah.
But I really love cosmology, the study of the origins of the universe. Really any study of origins, but particularly the study of the origins of the universe. So I actually, I like to watch, do you guys know who Lawrence Krauss is?
I haven't heard of him. Peter?
He's a famous physicist. He's an atheist, but he's got a series called the Origins Dialogues, I think it's called.
Now I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, and he's got some very interesting interviews with scientists, philosophers, and it's really great. But yeah, I really like that stuff, and it's honestly what I shouldn't admit this, but it's what I spend most of my time reading now. I read economics if I have to for my dissertation to, you know, cite the relevant literature, but I don't particularly enjoy it. There's very few books in economics that I've really enjoyed.
Yeah, they're all pretty dry. I'm reading Debunking Economics by Steve Keen, and I haven't made it very far into that because I keep falling asleep. I started reading The Invention of Capitalism by Perlman, I think. And that one's more interesting, but it's still just a slog.
I think, excuse me, the book that got me interested in economics initially was called When Corporations Rule the World.
Okay.
And I'm trying to remember the author now. But it was a very accessible book and full of empirical analysis. And so that was the book that more than anything made me think that I could, this is something that I wanted to become interested in. So I really liked that book. And then as I got along, got into it, I read a book called A Critical History of Economic Thought by, I think, A.K. Hunt. Mm-hmm. Again, these are all like tombs. But it was really interesting. And it was interesting because if you take an economics course, and I've taken one. It was in my first year of university, and it was just an option, and I took it, and I was appalled, and I never took an economics course again. And when I read this book, it all made sense because he goes through basically the time and place where each these contributions to theory were made and the reasons. And it was really interesting because he looks at the ideological defense. And if you look at neoclassical theory, for me, it never made any sense at all. But if you read this book, he talks about how these authors were interested in ideologically defending property rights and the income of capitalists. And so that was really interesting. And that when I realized... that economics really wasn't a science. It was more of an ideology.
Yeah, so yeah. Like, yeah, I think it's kind of, it occupies the same places like theology would have in the feudal era, I think. It's kind of just justifying the existing power structures and what they believe. I don't know. That's my feeling on it. There's no way to, like, I don't think there's a fair way to make that comparison or like a, you know, an objective way to do it. But, okay, so we have a bunch of questions that we wrote down for about your work. So I'll just start.
Just quickly a correction. Ryan wrote down a bunch of questions that he's got. I read your papers, but I'm still trying to understand them before I can formulate any questions. I've got like, I think, two questions or something.
Oh, well, maybe I can clarify some things.
Yeah, great. Okay, let Ryan get started.
Maybe it's not possible with available data, but would you consider a company hired by another company to have a hierarchical relationship that could affect income distribution? Like, in other words, you've looked at hierarchies within organizations, but could you look at hierarchies of organizations?
Yes, I think you certainly could. This is something that Jonathan Nitzan and I have talked about, because he's very interested in my research and he wants to take it in directions that I haven't actually thought about. And so, yeah, like the internal hierarchy of a company is the most obvious and the most concrete. And even then, there's not very good data on it.
Right, right.
Because, you know, payroll is private information and companies don't want to divulge it. But there's certainly, you know, firms own other firms. And so in that sense, it you could just kind of merge the two hierarchies. There's enormous possibility for this type of research. The problem is always finding good data.
Yeah, I guess you would have to kind of get a hold of either, you know, supply chain information and kind of assume which direction the hierarchy goes in, or find, you know, somehow get like contract information to see like who they're hiring out to, you know, produce things for them. So yeah, I guess data is always the main issue.
Yeah, it really is. And on that front, I've had for the paper that I already wrote on hierarchy and income distribution, I was trying to get a hold of raw data from papers that had studied, they'd done case studies of different firms, and so they summarized the results in the papers. But I emailed a whole bunch of different economists asking for their raw data, and nobody wanted to share with me. So I don't think this is a problem that's unique to economics, but it's definitely a problem in science. So
yeah, and you said they had to sign NDAs too for this data, right?
Yeah, they had to sign non-disclosure agreements, but still there are ways around that. For instance, one study, I mean, you can redact the sensitive information. So there is some publicly available data, actually, that an economist at the University of Chicago has put up online. And the firm is still anonymous. The people are obviously anonymous. And he's redacted all the data or the information that would maybe give a hint as to who these people are. So there's a ways around it. So I think it's definitely worth sharing data. I mean, that's what science depends on. Anyway, that's my own pet peeve.
While you guys are talking, it's going through my head. This kind of data would be collected by the SEC, wouldn't it?
Well, the SEC collects data, for instance, on executive pay. So I have actually pretty good data for executive pay, because that's mandated, I believe, by U.S. law, that corporations have to disclose their executive pay. But not the pay of individuals, and certainly not the chain of command structure of their organization.
Mm-hmm.
So these are... it's hard to come by. What might be the easiest is to do a study of the military, actually. That may be where data would be the most available.
But. Yeah, I was also earlier today looking at... have you heard of Glassdoor?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at Glassdoor. They have... I mean, obviously they don't have the command structure part there, but they have, you know, salary ranges for a lot of positions. So if you can get, like, the specific positions... a lot of them have data on how much they make, even for specific companies.
Interesting.
Okay, so you said in... I haven't read the full paper. I read Nitzan's expansion of the income distribution one, but you said in your presentation that utilities were the most equal companies due to the extensive regulations on them. So what were some of the most unequal ones?
Well, they tended to be They weren't in any specific sector. A lot of them were in finance. Mm-hmm. If you want, I can just pull up the paper. Now, there was no clear trend like with the most equal companies.
Yeah, I did work my way through the entire paper eventually. And I have to say, I couldn't find anything that was specifically sector specific, you know?
Yeah. And that was something when I did the analysis, I was really interested in. Okay, let me see here.
Okay, but and I think the question then would be, if regulation led to lower levels of inequality, then would deregulation lead to higher levels of inequality?
I think that's almost certainly the case. So, for instance, I don't know the specific regulation of the U.S. utility sector, but I do know Canada better. So Canada has a lot of what are called crown corporations, which are basically publicly owned corporations. And so in the utility sector, there's quite a few of them. And these CEOs in this sector are very low paid in relation to what they would be in the private sector. And there's Ontario, there's a list called the Sunshine List, where every public servant over 100 who earns over $100,000 is on this list, and it's publicly available. So it's almost kind of like a name and shame list, if you will. But so as a result, these executives in these crown corporations are just clawing to get off the Sunshine List and really to be sold. They want these companies to be privatized. And you know that if that happened, their pay would skyrocket, because it could. So I think, I don't know how the U.S., the laws in the U.S. work, but I do know that there has been substantial deregulation, specifically about how pay is reported. Mm-hmm.
Seems like it'd be pretty easy for them to get off the Sunshine List just by making a normal amount of money.
Well, that's true. Although the barrier now, $100,000, is not particularly high.
That's true.
But
that's
true. Yeah.
Okay. Were you able to observe any changes over time? Like, I mean, I'm sure this is limited by the data that you had available, but was there like a change in the structure of companies at all that, you know, corresponded with the increasing income inequality that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's really good data, and I'm not the first to observe this at all. Really good data showing that CEO pay has skyrocketed over the last 30 years. And the data that I used showed the same thing. And what that basically means is that income inequality within companies is increasing in the U.S. over the last, the data that I used was since 1990. So,
were there any like new, additional hierarchical levels, or is it still, such that, you know, they can manage the same or the growing number of people with the same number of levels?
Right. Well, see, I don't actually have, this is where the data limitations come in. I don't actually have very good data for you, the hierarchy of U.S. companies. I've kind of had to assume it. So I've taken a few case studies and looked at their structure and then kind of based on that built a model that applies kind of an assumption of this hierarchical structure to the U.S. companies. So I don't have good data for that. I do know, though, that there hasn't been much change in large firm size, though, over the last, since the 1970s, really, actually. Average, that was something that I looked at in an earlier paper. So,
as in, like, the size of the largest firms hasn't grown?
Yeah, it hasn't grown. And that's actually something that I so it turned, and this is where the energy consumption comes in. So it turns out that, so I should preface this. Most theories of economic growth, or neoclassical theory in general, says nothing about large institutions. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't exist in neoclassical theory because the idea is that perfect competition is best.
Right.
But what I found, the evidence, is that as energy consumption increases, which is how I like to measure economic growth, as energy consumption increases, firms get larger. So that means fewer people are self-employed, and more people work in the largest firms. So that's a pretty strong trend in the U.S. over the 20th century, but it basically peaked out in the 70s. And really, since the 70s, there's been no change in U.S. energy consumption per capita. And as a result, there's really been no growth of the largest companies.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't know either of those facts.
Yeah. Yeah, so as a result, there's probably not a lot of new hierarchical levels being added.
Okay.
And even if there were, this is something that's kind of counterintuitive, but just because a firm gets larger doesn't necessarily mean that it will be more unequal. Mm-hmm. The most important in terms of my own research and findings, the most important is how rapidly pay increases by hierarchical level. That matters much, much more than how many hierarchical levels are in a firm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So large firms are not any more unequal. Even though the CEO gets paid more, they're not any more unequal. And so that's kind of a paradox. I don't want to go too much into it because it involves a little bit of math, but that's
yeah, because I rewatched the presentation you did in September 2016, and you pointed out that like very small businesses, the employees actually tend to make more than the proprietor because there is no hierarchy. So I just assumed that larger businesses basically had, you know, ever growing levels of hierarchy, and that was the main cause of the income inequality in there.
Yeah, it's a little bit more subtle than that.
Yeah, yeah. So since we're talking about the energy aspect, I have questions on that one too. I didn't realize how interrelated your work on this was, so I kind of separated them out, but that's fine.
Before you move on to the energy stuff, I just quickly want to ask one question because we're busy talking about the hierarchy and the internal structures of the companies. Mm-hmm. While I was reading, it was quite obvious from the data that the hierarchical companies very robustly follow the power theory of income distribution. But I've spent the last several years looking into organizational culture, which was first properly described by some guys in the 60s and then expanded on by Henry Mintzberg in the study of management and all of that. And that field of inquiry has sort of found that there are four basic kinds of organizational culture. You know, there's the clan form, the market, the adhocracy, and the hierarchy forms of internal structure. And so my question is, would the power theory of income distribution apply to these different cultures, or is it strictly for your hierarchical organizational structures?
That's a good question.
Because I'll tell you what my thinking was while I was reading is that the small discrepancies that you can see in the actual data, it's entirely possible that these are accounted for by the different cultures. Obviously, hierarchy is the most prevalent of all organizational cultures.
Mm-hmm.
there's very few institutions that will implement an ad hoc system that is company-wide. You don't really find clan cultures outside of your Oriental nations. And although market culture has become more prevalent, it's still not as bureaucratically efficient.
Yeah, I think they tried that at Kmart and it went bankrupt or something.
While most of the data will probably represent that hierarchical culture, I feel like there's on the fringes you've got these various different cultures that can seem to throw the data out of whack.
Yeah. My own personal opinion is that I don't think there's really any alternative for hierarchy, for organizing large numbers of people. I would like there to be alternatives, but I don't see any alternatives in the world for that exist right now for, say, organizing 100,000 people cohesively. But that being said, there's enormous variation in kind of how steep the hierarchy is. So,
I
haven't studied this much, but I do know people have told me that, for instance, in Japan, there's this the span of control, which is how many employees and a manager is responsible for, is huge in Japan. Like, so as a result, companies are quite flat. There's not that many managers, and the managers oversee an enormous number of people. And because of that, then it means that each individual person has probably more autonomy. And I have a feeling that universities function like that. They're quite flat, but I think American corporations have a quite steep hierarchy. So there's, I think, variations on a theme. I think fundamentally all large human organizations have some sort of chain of command structure. Within that, how autonomous, you know, each level is and is probably quite variable. So my approach is always to kind of find the universal things first and then work out the details later. So there's obviously a lot of details to work out in this sort of thing.
Fair enough.
Yeah, as far as large organizations being managed by hierarchy, Professor Nitzan pointed out in his article on your work that CERN is an example where if there's not, you know, deep hierarchy like we would see in a corporation, it's very shallow because each position requires such specialized expertise that there's no one that could really give them orders. And that's at an organization of a few, like 10,000 scientists.
Yeah. And I agree with him there, and I think that's largely the case in academia I think the university as an institution is probably quite unique in that regard, is of having a whole bunch of quite autonomous individuals. I mean, I don't know of anything similar to university tenure in the private sector. Do you? Mm. I don't. So it's quite unique. But I haven't written about this, but a counterexample would be, like, what do you think the hierarchical structure was of the construction companies that built CERN, right? That's a little bit different. Uh-huh. That's more concrete and, analyzing and running the experiments is one thing, and it's very evidently very collaborative. Like, there's like 5,000 people on the CERN papers that are published. And I think that's great. I think it's fantastic, but I'm not sure. It's certainly one very useful counterexample of many people collaborating without much hierarchy.
I've found a while back, like I was saying earlier, I've looked for several years into organizational culture, and CERN came up several times under searches for adhocracy. Because essentially what they tend to do is they have these temporary groups that are formed with a specific purpose in mind, and once that purpose is achieved, that group dissolves and all the various members move off into other groups. And you can be a member of several groups at the same time, and there's no way to really say which one of those is a higher level as far as authority goes or anything like that. So, yeah, very, very ad hoc culture.
Yeah. And the arguments, so I've made kind of the same argument several times about why hierarchies exist. And the reasoning that I use is there's an anthropologist, his name is Robin Dunbar, who looked at this correlation between primate brain size and group size, and his argument was
Dunbar's number.
And so he then predicts the number for human beings, which is 150, which obviously doesn't really mean anything in human society now, right? I mean, we have organizations that are millions of people large. So my reasoning was, how do we get past Dunbar's number? Well, hierarchy kind of serves to limit human relations, because you only in a hierarchy have to have a relation with your superior and your subordinates, which are not very many people. So that's a kind of biological basis for why you would need hierarchy. But that being said, you don't. All that Dunbar's number implies is that we can't have an unlimited number of relations. So if we want to organize a large number of peoples, there has to be some sort of nesting. So, and
yeah,
that implies
I could see like a structure where you have like very very horizontal groups, but you know each group sort of selects like a delegate to represent
exactly.
The group. Yeah.
Yeah. So it would be kind of a hierarchy in the sense that
it's like a tree structure, but not a hierarchy.
A tree structure, but
without
on
top rules.
Power. Yeah. And accountability, really.
Yeah.
So that's what's lacking from most hierarchies is accountability. And I think that's one of the principal features of parliamentary democracy, is you still have this hierarchical government, but at least at the very top, you have, every 4 years, some degree of accountability. So that's better, but the idea of a lot of anarchists, and so people like, blanking on his name, he wrote a book called Participatory Economics, Michael Albert. His idea is that you want to take this a whole bunch further and have this nested committee structure with accountability. So it's an interesting idea. And beyond my research, but I'm interested in it.
It sounds very similar to Bookchin's work. Murray Bookchin.
How are you familiar with Bookchin, Blair?
Yeah, I have read one or two books. Back when there was a time when I was really interested. I was reading all the good anarchist literature, Bakunin and Bookchin, but kind of have had less time as my academic life has become more hectic. But
yeah,
I really enjoy that
hard to
literature.
Read.
Yeah.
Fun though.
Yeah. all right. So my next question is, so I've always had a feeling, not one that I've ever really tried very hard to prove, that capitalism or statecraft more generally would be impossible without pre-peak, as in like not peaked fossil fuels. In other words, do you think capitalist growth would be possible with renewable energy, given that it requires ever greater levels of energy to maintain the growing hierarchies that it creates?
No, I don't think so. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was one of the big things. When I got into grad school, Peak oil was still a big thing.
Right. Yeah, I think it radicalized a lot of people.
Yeah, I personally still think it is a big thing, but the press around it has completely died off. So when I got into this research, I was very interested in peak oil. And I think absolutely that capitalism is about, depending on how you want to date it, 200 to 500 years old. And that period is pretty remarkable in human history in terms of the discovery and exploitation of fossil fuels. I don't think it's repeatable. So I've been very interested in this concept of energy return on investment. Have you guys?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So,
for the listeners, it basically is the amount of energy that you get out from, say, drilling for oil, relative to how much you put into it.
Yeah, exactly. So, the term was coined by Charlie Hall, who was a ecologist by training. And he's attracted kind of this, excuse me, school of thought around him, where people are analyzing all the different energy sources, looking at their quality in terms of energy return on investment. And the news for renewables is pretty bad. Solar energy. The energy return on investment on solar energy is controversial, the estimates, but they're all generally low compared to oil.
Yeah.
So
I think wind has the highest of the renewable technologies outside of hydro, which doesn't really count. But
I mean, the biggest limiting factor is for me cities and how many people can live in cities if you're building your grid off of solar and wind. And I think it's much less than now. And so I think, who knows when this will happen, but I do think that capitalism will have to die.
Yeah. Cause there's, I think it's Herman Daly that, has this idea of a steady state economy that, you know, capitalism can be reformed into a system without growth. But, from the very idea of capitalization where you're expecting future increases in revenue, it seems like there's no real way for those two things to reconcile with each other.
Yeah, compound interest. And actually, on that topic, there's a really good book by an anthropologist named David Graeber, and it's called Debt: The First 5,000 Years.
Yeah, I love that book.
Yeah, really good book.
We're big fans of Graeber.
Yeah. And one of the really interesting things he does is look kind of the history of debt and the history of compounding interest and how it before modern capitalism, but basically went in cycles of increasing debt, accumulating through interest, obviously, and then debt jubilees. So basically people will become more and more indebted until the point that they just couldn't live. And either the whole system goes bankrupt or you basically eliminate the debt. So you'd have these kind of cycles. And so in that sense, you can have compounding interest and capital accumulation, but it's not exponential growth then. It's just cyclical, expand and collapse, which is, I guess, how most things are in nature is cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not ideal, I don't think.
So I haven't made that connection before to the debt jubilee. So I wonder if there's maybe any evidence of cyclical energy growth and decline that sort of corresponds to that.
I honestly don't know. The data for energy consumption for ancient societies is quite sketchy. So,
I'm sure.
creating time series. I'm not aware of any time series, which is what you'd want.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very it's very interesting to think about it. Yeah.
You were going to say something, Peter?
I've lost it. Don't worry about it.
All right. Is there is there any evidence that higher levels of energy become harder to maintain? I guess I meant within one organization. I don't know.
Higher level. See, well, I actually don't. I can't really comment on that because I don't have any data on actual energy use by specific companies.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, it's something that I've always wanted to look at, but there's no data.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This actually relates to what we were just talking about. Which is would it be possible for growth of revenue to occur even without a corresponding increase in actual material or energy use? As in, if capitalists are fighting over a dwindling resource base that's beyond its peak, could they still engage in this game of capitalization without it really corresponding to any like real?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the great things about capital as power, and that whole book really demolishes the idea that capital accumulation has anything to do with real assets. Mm-hmm. So that for me was very liberating. What Knudsen and Bichler do then is say that capital and capital accumulation is about distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Period. Right. It's about power, which is about distribution. So capital accumulation, when you have exponential growth of energy consumption, is not a problem because there's more resources to go around. So if there's concentrating tendencies resulting from capital accumulation, they're kind of fixed as you go along, or just kind of, what's the word? A rising tide lifts all boats, right?
Yeah.
Anytime there's a crisis, so you don't have growth. Well, think about what the crisis is. It's not a crisis in anybody's standard of living per se, right? Nobody goes, or very few people go broke all of a sudden. You still have your car, you still have your house. It's a crisis in terms of distribution, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we can imagine that there's still capital accumulation occurring as energy consumption decreases, but it would have huge. I mean, you're fighting then over a shrinking pie, and so society, I think, would become much less cohesive and much less tolerant of capitalist power, mm-hmm. right? So I think that's the key problem. Yeah, I don't think.
Yeah, you made me think of this figure that I saw a couple of years ago, and I think it was for the period between 2009, so after the crisis, and then between that and 2014 or so, and it was that the top 1% has captured 90% of all new income. So what's really being accumulated is the new sources of revenue, and so most other people can kind of stay at the same level of quality of life, while the quality of life of the upper echelons of society is kind of increasing, you know, vastly faster.
Yeah, and that's excuse me, that's a pretty clear trend since 1970, right?
Mm.
I don't believe government statistics about real GDP. I've actually been really, Jonathan Knudsen was actually the person who first kind of pointed me in this direction of thinking that measure is nonsense.
Oh, are you talking about the real GDP per capita and productivity?
Yeah, I don't think real GDP is a measure of productivity.
Yeah.
We don't need to go into the whole debate, but
and productivity itself is really just a measure of. It's not like most people think of it as the amount of stuff that's being produced, but it's really the amount of revenue that's being produced from some income, right?
Sure. Well, yeah, let's just talk about in neoclassical theory, the way they built the theory is that productivity is output per unit of labor, and mm-hmm. and they conveniently use a one commodity economy, which means widgets, let's say.
Right.
Output is widgets, and it's really easy then to say if productivity increases. But then The problem is then they move to the real world where there's many, many different economies, or products rather, and they keep this, but they keep this physical notion of output, which I think makes sense to try to do, because that's what people, when they talk about productivity, really mean, you know, making more cars, more computers, and etc. But the problem then is to try to aggregate all of these things into a single unit. And so economists use price to aggregate. And so really the way they measure productivity is not in any physical sense, but it's in terms of the value of output, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's got huge, huge problems. So I don't think it has anything connected to physical productivity anymore. So I wrote a book called Rethinking Economic Growth Theory from a Biophysical Perspective. And one of the arguments that I put in the book is that if you want to look at growth from a scientific perspective, you should use energy consumption, because energy is related to the laws of thermodynamics. And we know from thermodynamics that any system that's going to grow and become more complex has to increase its energy consumption. So in my own research, then I use energy consumption as a physical measure of a physical measure of the growth of the economy. So just getting back to my original point is that energy consumption per capita in the U.S. has not increased since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, there's been no growth, and really what then people are fighting over a static pie.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense.
Nitsan in his article on your work pointed out that, and maybe you did it as well, I don't know, pointed out that increasing energy per capita is unique to capitalism. Is it possible that either capitalization made this possible, or that capitalization took over out of necessity to manage that increasing energy per capita thanks to technology?
Well, yeah. You're talking about the origins of capitalism, which is a huge ongoing debate.
Yeah.
You might find, have you read any books by Tim DiMuzio?
No.
He's got a book about, I think he calls it fossil capitalism, or anyway. You should look up, because he's a student of Jonathan Knudsen. He writes about capitalist power, but he's very interested in energy consumption. My own thinking about capitalism is that it's key so there's always been kind of concentrations of power, at least since agriculture. Before agriculture, hunter-gatherer societies, there's really no power structure per se. But since agriculture, there's always been a power structure, and it's generally, as Knudsen and Bickler point out, it's tied to an ideology. And most of these ideologies have been quite static. They're related to religion often, and the power structure is usually hardened into like a feudal caste system, which is not dynamic at all. So, but with the growth of fossil fuel consumption, that really has to, and it has to be dynamic, because there's just change. The pace of change has increased exponentially. So I don't know which caused which, but capitalism is a dynamic system of power, right? Your power, if capital is power, then your power is a quantity, and it can change over time easily. And it's really easy to be dynamic, whereas before, you know, your power is tied specifically to a position. So I think that's the key strength of capitalism. But as far as how it started and how it relates exactly to fossil fuels, I have no idea.
Okay. So speaking of really very early states, have you read Against the Grain by James Scott?
No, I read a review of it, and it looks really good. So
yeah, I just finished it recently, and it actually kind of inverts that early history where most people currently think that agriculture led to statecraft, but the evidence now is that it kind of happened in reverse, which is that there were non-state societies that were sedentary, and they had all of the technologies of agriculture. The only thing that really changed was when states started trying to form, it was much easier to manage people through agriculture because grain is very conducive to bureaucracy. So it's very countable. It's easy to transport and store. It's easy to steal. So like it's easy to confiscate. So like come harvest time, it all matures at the same time, and they can kind of send in their soldiers and confiscate the grain if you're not, you know, paying your taxes voluntarily. It's definitely worth a read. Very much changes my perspective on early statecraft.
Yeah, I will. I do intend to read it. It looks very interesting. And right. And that's something that Jonathan, I think, that Knitson and Bickler articulate in their article, Growing Through Sabotage, mm-hmm. that their thinking is that hierarchy, I don't know, maybe I'm getting this backwards. No, I shouldn't comment because I don't want to get it backwards. But that's very interesting. And I've read some other papers that look at the origin of states in terms of theft and the ability to steal grains. So that's interesting. Yeah. That's one of the other origins that I'm interested in, the origin of social inequality. And there's an edited book by Gary Feynman and Ray Price. Not Ray Price. Anyway, it's called what is it called? Power. Oh, it's a really good book about the origin of social inequality. Pathways to Power.
Okay.
Pathways to Power. Yeah, I would recommend that book. It's maybe not as it's an edited book, so it's maybe not as well written as the one you were just talking about, but it's very interesting. Different theories of how social inequality emerged.
Since you're working on your dissertation, you're probably not working on anything terribly new. Are you looking into any new areas to add to the dissertation, or are you kind of just synthesizing your research?
Well, the paper that I'm working on now has new results, actually, that I'm quite interested in or excited about. And what it's going to do is actually look at, or one of the things it will do is look at how a power theory of income distribution can relate to what economists would call functional income distribution. So for functional income distributions means the distribution of capitalist income relative to laborers. And so that one of the ideas that I'm developing in this paper is that this is actually related to hierarchy. And that I think that actually as you move up a hierarchy of a, let's say, a corporate hierarchy, I should preface it by saying there's this old idea that basically the capitalists are captains of industry, right? They're the Bill Gates and the Steve Jobs, and going back earlier, the Rockefellers. So they're really the top of the if you want to think in terms of hierarchy, they're just the top.
Right.
So the person at the top is a capitalist. But I don't think that makes much sense anymore, because you have, if you look at the pay structure of corporations, many people at the top of the hierarchy and on down are making income from dividends. So I have this idea that there's actually a gradient. And as you move up the hierarchy in the corporate hierarchy, income from capitalist sources increases till where you get to the top of a very big corporation. CEOs are often making all of their income from capitalist sources, which would be basically stock options.
So someone can be more or less capitalist.
Yeah, so you can basically have a a gradation of being a capitalist, right? Mm-hmm. I am a capitalist in the sense that I have money in a bank earning interest, mm-hmm. and but it's, you know, for, and most people would be in the same boat, but it's essentially nothing for them, right? Right.
Yeah, I've heard that argument from libertarians where they say, like, oh, you have a problem with capitalists? Like, well, guess what? Most people in the country have a 401k, so by your logic.
So this is taking that kind of observation about the real world, which could be used to say, you know, everybody's a capitalist, so we can't critique this system. But then to show that really it's a gradient, and as you move up the hierarchy, you become more and more and more capitalist until you get to the top and you're really a capitalist. So that's what I'm working on now, and I think the results are quite promising.
Oh, looking forward to that. Have you read any of David Ellerman's work?
No, I haven't.
So that's the last thing I read, and I just took a bunch of notes yesterday and the day before to do like a solo podcast episode on it. But one of the things that he points out is that much more important than like the traditional Marxist idea of private ownership of the means of production is the employment contract, because it's the employment contract that really allows the business owner to both tell employees like what to do and to appropriate the revenue that they get from doing it. And mm-hmm. He expands that to, well, and I kind of synthesized it with capitalist power, where like Ellerman points out that you can be a business and have means of production and be a firm, which he defines as the person who essentially is like the prime mover of an industrial process, where like, mm-hmm. You know, say Apple, they, you know, create the iPhone and then they hire a bunch of other companies that own the means of production to produce the iPhone. But they're the ones that ultimately decide, you know, how much it costs and what the distribution of revenue is. Mm-hmm. So I think that a capitalist really, and, you know, you could apply this with the gradient idea, but a capitalist really is someone who is appropriating income, and they do so by having capital, which, you know, is required to initiate the process of doing something with industry. I don't know if that was too rambling or what.
Well, without having read his work, but just taking what your summary is, I agree. And for me, I've thought, like, what does it mean to own a firm? If, let's say, you owned Apple somehow, all of Apple, what does that really mean? I mean, in historical, or in Marxists say, you own the means of production. Mm-hmm. But for my thinking is that when you own a firm, yeah, you own some technology, which you could call the means of production, but that can change, and I don't think it's particularly important. So in the case of Apple, they literally don't produce their own product, right? As you said, they subcontract it out. So what do you own? Well, essentially, a firm is basically a hierarchy. So as the owner of the hierarchy, you have legal grounds to govern it. So essentially, Noam Chomsky calls them private tyrannies, right? It's its own little feudal manor. And of course, you can't do whatever you want to your employees, but you have enormous amount of power over what they do. So, and as a result of that, you get to take the income stream that firm generates and divide it up how you see fit. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that, so I as a Marxist would say that the employees generate the value and then you appropriate it. I don't agree. I think that obviously the employees are necessary for creating whatever product you have. Mm-hmm. So they're obviously necessary, but then you gain an income stream basically by your ability to restrict that product. So that's where Jonathan Knudsen and Shimshon Bickler's ideas come in is real. The only way that something can get a price is if you have property rights and the ability to restrict it. So labor doesn't create value. You create labor creates products, and then to get a value, you have to have property rights to restrict it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can imagine having really no product at all. Let's say you had some guns, and you could block off a road and collect a toll.
Yeah.
You don't really have any product at all, but because you are able to enforce property rights, you could collect a toll, which is then income. So that's the key to generating the income. And then as the owner, you get to distribute it however you want. I think that's a good way of thinking about it, about capitalist power, definitely.
Peter, do you have anything?
Man, I've been sitting here the whole time listening to how the awesome books you guys have been reading. Like, the last thing I read was Harry Potter. And I think the only thing that I still am a little bit curious about is I wrote this question down very clumsily. So first I'm going to read the question, then I'm actually going to ask the question. What I wrote was, what variables were the most difficult to control for? I.e., do you think things like individual personality traits might have a larger effect on the data than expected? And what I meant by this was, does a CEO's personality affect the kind of income distribution you would see within a firm?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And I have no answers. We can speculate, though.
I was thinking about Amazon versus Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And how...
Yeah, we just did an episode on Jeff Bezos. So
we learned
a lot about Amazon.
If you look at the two corporations... Their CEOs are given vastly different scores, if you want to call it that, based on how well liked they are by their employees.
Okay. Can you elaborate more? I don't know, actually.
I don't have the article in front of me right now, but there was...
Who is better liked?
Jeff Bezos is notorious for being kind of a dick. He actually took training to... stop yelling at people for making him mad.
Okay.
Yeah. Zuckerberg. I think Tim Cook is very well liked. Yeah, Tim Cook very well liked. Zuckerberg very well liked. I mean, now we're talking within the billionaire echelons. We're not talking about your small business owners. Obviously, there's no way to track. Who the most liked boss in the world is, but within these massive corporations, there is this variable scale of liked versus completely hated bosses, and Jeff Bezos happens to score right at the top of the pack for most hated. I'm very curious to know whether or not this would have any kind of effect on pay scales, because clearly, there's some sort of personality or set of personality traits involved with how the internal hierarchies are set up.
I think it's a really interesting research question. I can't comment because I have no idea what the results you would find. I should maybe contrast this with, there's kind of two lines of thought, which one is the systemic organization, and the other is the characteristics of individual firms and differences between firms. And so, and you could do this for any kind of social organization, right? You could do it for slavery, because there's probably slave owners that are nice to their slaves, and there's obviously slave owners that are terrible to the slaves. And so you could do a study of that. And the same with CEOs. And my hunch is that you would probably be able to find personality traits that you could identify with a fairly low CEO pay and maybe a equal distribution within the firm. Because basic, you know, a CEO, let's say you're a completely private company, you have absolute control over how you distribute income within your firm. So your personality traits, I think, are very important. Like there was a famous interview with, I believe it's Arthur Schlesinger, some very high up individual in the U.S. government who had just come from the private sector, and they were talking about, you know, as a CEO, you could have paid yourself hundreds or thousands of times more than the average employee, but you paid yourself, like, I think 10 times maybe or less. And he said doing anything else would be unthinkable. So there's enormous amount of your personality that goes into this. That being said, though, there is the systemic part of this, which is that over the last 40 years, CEO pay has increased enormously. So that can't be really you can't chalk that up to personality, because I don't think it makes much sense to. There's some sort of social shift.
Yeah, you might be able to argue there's some cultural impact on personality, but that's probably a stretch.
My take on that would probably be that by increasing the pay, you're busy getting, you're eliminating from the playing field the Schlesingers that then find it unthinkable to take that kind of pay. Mm-hmm. So you're basically attracting the apex social predators. And this would be a feedback loop of sorts. That would escalate and result in the kind of escalation in CEO pay that we've seen in the last 40 years.
Yeah. And I think there's pretty good research also to show that a kind of class mentality matters too, right? Like coming out of World War II, I think there was a kind of universal class mentality that the whole of, at least U.S. society, was kind of in it together. So as a result, CEOs kind of kept their pay in line. And there was also, let's not forget, very high taxes at the time on top incomes. But over time, I think executives have really developed their own kind of social class. Like, right, there's this whole interlocking directorate between different firms. And so as soon as you start to think of yourself only in terms of other executives and not in terms of the average employees, there's really no reason to keep your pay in check. You're right. You're an elite individual, and you think you're.
Yeah, there was that interesting presentation. I don't remember who did it, but it was about how the very wealthy have sort of created their own internal economy. Where they have goods just for themselves. And the guy who was presenting it, I wish I had the YouTube channel up right now, but he was talking about how they have like all these like extremely fancy like pens and yachts and you know, just an entire luxury economy just for kind of executives.
For the wealthy people, by the wealthy people.
One other thing I thought of, because I read Peter's question before we started this, was that, you know, if you change CEOs and one of them has a different personality than another, there's sort of like an organizational inertia. Like, they can't just restructure the entire company single-handedly, you know, as soon as they come in. So it would be hard to attribute a lot of changes to personality, especially if, you know, a company changes CEOs with any regularity.
This actually, when I first arrived here in Bahrain, I was doing some supply chain management for the Four Seasons Hotel, and it was interesting. Because essentially what I had to do was come in, take a look at everything, and automate wherever possible. And it turned out that pretty much my entire job could be automated, and I automated myself out of a job within 3 months. But this makes me wonder whether replacing a CEO with another CEO, at the moment, it's the only real option. But as AI develops, whether it could at a later stage be possible for these organizational shifts to become more radical as a CEO is replaced by an algorithm.
Yeah, and so then it would just be a machine to generate wealth for shareholders, I guess.
I guess, but I mean, if that's regulated by a heavily socialist government, for instance, it might not end up being specifically developed by shareholders for shareholders.
Yeah.
It could be mandated that a specific algorithm gets used by all companies and that this distributes income more fairly.
And, yeah.
Although I do get the point. At the moment, while you could have different personality traits, the sheer momentum of a company like Apple and the direction they've been going in for the last 2 decades, just about, it's unlikely to change just because they shifted from
Steve Jobs to Tim Cook. And there's this whole, a huge feedback too, right? Because you hear this argument all the time, and I hear it even at York University, where the president makes a lot of money, not by private sector standards, but certainly in historic terms in Canada, the president makes a lot of money. And you hear, and basically the argument is, well, if we want to be competitive and find the best individuals, we have to pay this amount.
Oh yeah.
So at a certain point, you just have to buy into the game, right? If you want, even in PLOS One, the science paper, which is open access, very progressive, they pay their CEO quite a bit of money. And again, their argument is, well, we have to if we want to find a good individual. So if everybody else is doing it and you don't want to have, you know, schmucks in your executive, you kind of have to join in. So it's a catch-22.
Yeah. It's interesting, though. I remember reading a paper. I won't even be able to come up with the title or authors, but it was about how company performance was dictated a lot more by middle management than by the CEOs. And so their conclusion was basically like high CEO pay is kind of just a waste of money.
Yeah, I don't think there's any good data showing that CEO pay relates to company performance at all. So that argument is pretty much moot.
That seems like it could be easily looked at with the available data. Because you said executive pay is available from the SEC, right?
Oh, yeah, there has been a lot of studies, yeah.
Any from the capitalist power perspective, though, in terms of like the differential?
No, most of them are quite neoclassical.
Okay. Maybe I'll take a look at that someday.
But no, my thinking about CEO pay is really, if you want to fix the problem, it's through oversight and regulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's all I have. Anything else, Peter?
I'm good, man. This has been such an informative session.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I actually understand what I've read in the last 2 days a lot better now.
Oh, that's good. I appreciate you guys asking me questions. Yeah, it's fun.
Is there like what's the best place to follow you if people want to follow your work?
Well, I have all my papers published on academia.edu. So if you just Google Blair Fix, F-I-X, my name will pop up on academia.edu, and you can read my papers. They're also on the Capitalist Power website. I post on the forum there regularly, as well as a lot of other people. So that's probably the best way to check out these ideas.
Great. All right, Blair. think we got a good show. So thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Later.